Okay, we'll convene the regular and supplemental meetings and recess the supplemental meeting. We'll start with a moment of silence for those who have passed since our last meeting, police and firemen that are on item A of our books, page 5 of the presentation. We'll take a moment of silence, please. Okay, thank you. I would also suggest we have a moment of silent prayer for those brave police and firemen who are fighting the pandemic, as well as the healthcare workers out there, and that we hope that they stay free from the virus and that anybody who does contact it heals rapidly. So let's just have a moment for that as well. Okay, thank you. Our first order of business is approval of the minutes from the regular meeting of March 12th. People have seen that. Does anybody have any comments or changes they'd like to make to those minutes? Hearing none, can we get a motion to approve?
So move.
Thank you. Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. And then we have the special meeting here. This, I'm just going through the, that it will be on page 14, which was just the, giving Kelly the authority to take during this period of time on personnel policies and issues. Any discussion? If not, can we get a motion to approve it?
Motion. So moved.
Second, can we get a second?
Second.
Yeah.
Thank you. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? No. Okay, that carries. Then we have the consent agenda. Is there anything unusual on the consent agenda that we should be aware of?
There are three things that I wanted to point out. The first was we do have a survivor benefit this time, or that the paperwork isn't complete, and we've indicated that by an asterisk. So as soon as that is complete, we'll get that paid. But we do this just to remind you so the survivor doesn't have to wait an extra month for their payment. The other thing I wanted to point out is you'll see there's a lot of retirements this month. There's 18, which is very high. Last year, we only had 3 months more than 18, and same in 2018. We only had three higher than that. One of the reasons, well, the primary reason that this is high is because the interest rate changed for people leaving active service in April, and it was going down pretty significantly, so a lot of people accelerated their retirement. So that's why you'll see that uptick. And also on this agenda is a denial of a hardship request. This was a member who requested less than $2,000. The reason for the request was an allowable reason, but their financial resources indicated they had sufficient funds to pay this with the information that they provided us. So I'm recommending denial on that hardship.
Okay. Any questions for Kelly on the consent agenda? Hearing none, can we get a motion to approve it?
Alan moves.
Thank you, Alan.
Second.
Second.
Okay, thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? No. John, are you moving the Zoom? I'm kind of on the first page still.
Yes, we don't present the detailed consent agenda to the public.
Okay, so now we're up to ask, is anybody from the public want to speak? Is there a way for you to know that, John?
Yeah, they'll press 5-star. I'll get an alert that they want to ask the question.
Okay, we'll give it a
While they're doing that, Bill, can you clarify for me who was the second on the consent agenda?
We had two or three. Who is the second on the consent agenda?
Steve Ido.
Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome.
Yeah, this is Josh. If y'all could just identify yourselves if you're making a motion or a second, that'd be helpful. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Okay, do we have anybody, John?
No, I don't see anybody.
Yeah, we only have a very small handful of people out there, I guess, listening in, so. Okay.
Well, Bill, I was told that Mr. Garcia wanted to speak. I don't know if we want to ask specifically if he does. Maybe change his mind.
Yes.
I now have one
Yes,
question.
I do.
Okay, thank you.
You want me to unmute for the question?
Yes. Well, yeah, please do.
This is Jerry. Jerry Rhodes. I've missed a couple of meetings. I just want to say good morning to everybody and thank you for everything that you're doing for us. We appreciate it very much, and I hope you have a good day. Appreciate your help.
Thank you, Jerry. Appreciate it. Is there a Mr. Garcia that wanted to speak? Or?
Yes, this is Furman Garcia. Are you referring to me or Gilbert Garcia?
No, I believe to you, Furman.
Okay. First of all, good morning, board. I couldn't get onto Zoom, so I can't see you guys. I'm just on the phone. My name is Furman Garcia. I was a police officer with the Dallas Police, badge number 7173, from 94 to 2000 when I left and got other employment. I first walked into the pension office back in November of 2016 and met with the benefits counselor by the name of Cynthia Trish. She explained to me, when I could receive my benefits at the age of 50, which was in September of last year, and the amount that I was going to get, right? After that, I was in Laredo, Texas, and I was going to be moved or I got ordered to move to D.C. Beginning between January and June. I was supposed to report up here. Anyhow, in January, I contacted the pension office again, and I told them the circumstance that I was going to be driving by Dallas and that I was going to turn 50 in September, and what I needed. So they advised me to bring my birth certificate, my Social Security, copy of my Social Security for myself and my wife, my marriage license, and a voided check so they could deposit my check. In June, I dropped by the office. I brought everything with me. Miss Ann Matthews was graciously met with me. I told her I had the documents. She said it was too early for me to submit in June. I did tell her, I said, I'm passing through. I'm going to D.C. I don't have an address. I only have my work address that I could give. So I gave her my work address. Been in contact with her. I received the paperwork in the mail. I mailed all the items in December. I tried several times to call Ms. Matthews. I left her messages. I finally got in touch with her late March, and I explained to her that I wasn't paid for September, October, and November, and she told me that I couldn't get paid because the paperwork was submitted in December. So there was no retroactive pay. At any point in time when I met at the office, this was never told to me. Matter of fact, when I met with Ms. Matthews in June, she said the board was going to meet in October and I would get retroactive pay for September. So I'm asking the board to vote in my favor to get paid for September, October, and November. I feel like I served the city of Dallas. I served the citizens of Dallas, and I should get that pay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I guess we can go back. We hear you. I'll look into it. Kelly, do you want to add anything now, or do you want to review this with us separately?
We have looked at this internally, and I can tell you I think that we followed our policies and informed the member timely via certified letter that his benefit was due to start. We didn't receive the paperwork timely, but if we want to talk about any legal ramifications, we can probably do that in the legal closed session, right, Josh, if there's a concern we're not following the policy or the plan?
This is Josh. I'm the lawyer. This is a public comment section, and Mr. Garcia, you've indicated your concerns, and this is really not a discussion item. So I think that the board can certainly take it up at a future board meeting in substance. But I think for now you've certainly identified your issues, and at this point, I think it would be appropriate to move on to another public comment or another agenda item.
Okay. We will look into it and follow your advice, Josh, to look into it, and then we'll get back with Mr. Garcia. Okay. Is there any other public comments, John?
No, I don't see anybody that has indicated they want to talk.
Okay, then let's move on to monthly contribution report.
Okay, on page 20 of the diligent presentation is the summary page of all of the data. This month's report is through February data, and you can see that our trends are still going in the right direction. For the month of February, we received $10.8 million of city contributions. So for the month, we were 103% of the hiring plan for contributions and 95% of the floor, just slightly below that for the 2 months. Since the inception of HB 3158, we're at 98% of the hiring plan and 90% of the floor. So things are looking good. I can tell you that there was a small drop-off in the number of employees. They're still above their estimate in the hiring plan, but there are 22 less on the February payroll than the January payroll. And we are aware that they did cancel a rookie class earlier. I can't remember if it was late April or early March, but I have since heard actually on the news that they were going to hold rookie classes virtually, so hopefully they'll be able to keep up with their hiring, and kind of surge in retirements will be made up for pretty quickly. So I think things are on track.
Hey, Kelly, it's Armando.
Hi, Armando.
Are you referring to the rookie class on the fire side or the police side?
It was the police one.
I don't know
what's going on the fire side.
Yeah, we just pushed a class from March to April, and they're starting April the 15th.
Okay, that's good. I'm glad they're starting. The class I was referring to was actually scheduled for April 2nd in the police, and that one was delayed, and I think now doing it virtually.
Okay. Anything else on this? Anybody? Okay, if not, let's move on to the trustee terms and elections you wanted to cover.
Yes, so on page 24 of the diligent packet is the discussion sheet for this item. And what this is talks about the trustee terms that are expiring in 2020. The trustee election procedures require that I let you know which terms are expiring in April, so that's what I'm doing with this item. I've also presented for you the 2020 election schedule. So I think we're all aware that Bill, Nick, and Susan's terms expire this year. They're mayoral appointees, so there's not a lot the board does related to that. Of course, we need to reach out to the mayor timely and hope that everybody gets reappointed. So we need to do that. And I know Bill has been trying to schedule a meeting with the mayor even before the COVID crisis. So hopefully we'll be able to do that. The police and firefighter positions, Joe and Armando's, are also up on August 31st of 2020. So I've attached an election schedule for that. Depending on what you're looking at on page 25 of Diligent, if you're looking at Diligent versus looking at the PDF, you might see a different first line on this because I actually had an error in what I put in the original PDF. But today we're approving, I'm asking the board to approve the election schedule. Before I had that as May 14th, but we've moved that up. The plan is that on May 14th or sooner, we will put out a call for candidates, and we will send that to all active and pensioners of the system because the firefighter and police position, trustees positions, can be either active or retired, even though only the active members get to vote on it. It could be either an active or retired. So we'll put that out May 14th at the latest. Application packages will be due back June 2nd. At the June board meeting, the board will review those applications to make sure that the applicant meets the minimum qualifications. That is a requirement in 6243A-1. They'll do that. Voting begins June 25th to July 7th, and then the board will certify the elections on July 9th. If a runoff election is required because no candidate has received more than 50% of the votes, we'll then start that process right away with a voting period from July 21st to August 4th, the board certifying the trustees August 13th, and then the terms begin September 1st. So that is the plan. It's drawn out, but we have to do that just to make sure we have time for a runoff election if necessary. Are there any questions?
I don't know, Joe and Armando, this sounds pretty reasonable to you guys.
Yes, it is, Joe. I think it's similar to what we've done in the past.
Good.
Yes, sir. It's Armando. Yeah, it looks like a good process, and we've done this a couple times before. So, yeah, looks good.
Okay, so we do need a motion to approve the schedule.
So moved. This is Gilbert.
Gilbert, thank you, Gilbert.
It's Tina.
Alan, second.
Who was that? Tina, second?
Yes.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? No. Okay. Good enough. Our next item is, are we on the drop policy now?
We are.
Yes.
It's on page 27 of Diligent. And the reason that I'm bringing this item to the board is it's a clarification item. We don't currently have any members that are in this situation. It came about because I'm working on rewriting the member handbooks, and it was just a question that came out of that process. So the IRS determines what happens when a member retires from the system and then gets rehired back with the city. It really dictates what happens with their pension benefit itself. But it doesn't speak to what happens with their drop annuity. There are rules, really, with the IRS that does indicate that. But our drop policy was really silent to what happens if you retire, you begin receiving a drop annuity, and then you rehire back with the police or fire department. So we just wanted to clarify that for members in case they're considering that. I know the police department often does have some rehires. The fire department rarely does, except for people with kind of, not a whole lot of experience, not really retirees. So on page 37 of this policy, we've added a paragraph to basically say, if you retire from the city and you were in drop and now you've begun your drop annuity, when you go back and you work, your drop annuity will be on hold during the time you're now working. You will, if you haven't hit your 10 years in drop, you'll actually start accumulating more drop money into kind of a separate new drop balance pool. Your existing drop annuity, you won't be getting payments on that because that would be an in-service distribution, so you can't be made payments on that, but you're not going to lose it. So when you then later leave active service for the second time, your initial annuity will be reannuitized with the same interest rate and the same end date. You'll just get bigger payments to make up for what you've lost. And then you'll have a second annuity for the new money, if that makes sense. So we're making sure people don't lose any of their drop annuity, and we're not violating the in-service distribution fees.
Historically, does it happen often?
It's never happened. It was just a thought of, it just seemed like kind of a hole if, you know, we wanted to be clear in the policy. It hasn't happened yet. A lot of the people that do rehire haven't actually retired from the city. They've had a few years with the city and maybe come back, but they have had an effort to rehire some retirees in the past, and this is just to put it in place so people understand. We thought we'd do it now that we were thinking about it with the handbook.
So let me ask you a question, sure. Kelly. And I don't want to spend too much time on it because it's kind of like a hypothetical. It's in place in case it occurs. But you're saying that you kind of hold the drop annuity payment, you add to the coffer, so to speak, but when they initiate again, it's back to the initial rate when they initially got their drop annuity?
Right. So they won't be in a better or a worse position on as far as an interest rate or how long it takes to get paid out. So everybody is made that way. They'll just get higher payments each month to make up for those that they lost.
Well, isn't it, Kelly, a dual rate? That's the amount on the drop that previously existed would be at the existing rate, but any new drop accounts would be at whatever rates that occurred when they retire the second time. Isn't that the way it works?
It is the way it works, except for the fact that any money that goes into drop after 9/1/17 has no interest. So basically their new chunk of drop won't have any interest because it will be after 9/1/17.
No, but annuitization rate we use to annuitize it will be the rate in effect when they retire the second time around, is it correct?
No. Well, except for there is no interest rate. So the new money that goes in after 9/1/17 gets zero interest.
Okay.
That's in the plan. But
Kelly, why wouldn't you just do like what Social Security does with people who often just retire but still work? And they get their Social Security benefits, but they just – and it's more separate. Or why wouldn't you just do that? Like, let them – I'm confused how, why is it like you just – well, maybe that's for all.
Well, they can't be getting – they can't have in-service distribution, so they can't be getting retirement payments from the pension while they are in active service. That's why.
Yeah, I got it. I see the
logic. So we don't want them to lose anything. We don't want them to lose it. So it's not like it hit their 10 years and they're forfeiting the money. We're just holding it for them and giving it to them.
I get it now. I had an epiphany. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay, any other questions? Hopefully we don't have to use this, but can we get a motion to approve this amendment?
It's Tina. I'm motion.
Okay. Second?
Alan, second.
Alan, second. Thank you, Alan. Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Nope. Okay, it carries unanimously. Thank you. Okay. Now we're moving on to the vacation and travel approval, if there is any.
There is none on this. This is page 45 of Diligent. We don't have any requests, so there's no action that needs to happen on this item.
Great. Okay. You want to update us on our how we're operating?
Yes. Let me pull up my notes here. Okay. So as you all are aware, we began remote working on March 16th. On that day, we kind of had a transition day where about half the staff was in that day. And the next couple of days, you know, we trickled down and just had a few people, and we were really pushing to get the March payroll done, for the pension payroll done early, to make sure everything went out at the end of March timely and accurately. So we were able to do that pretty quickly. We rushed in an accounts payable run at that time. So currently what's happening is a few people are going into the office occasionally as needed. So mail is picked up every Monday, Wednesday, Friday. We actually tried to do it. We switched to two times a week, but we get too much mail for that. So somebody goes in every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, opens the mail, scans it to the appropriate person so that information is processed timely. Occasionally other staff members will go into the office to process checks, to process payroll, to do some scanning and some other limited items. We let everybody know when somebody's going to be in there. John and Damian are in the office right now. We still have janitorial. They're making extra efforts on areas, especially where the mail is processed, because that's the most hands-on with the scanners, the copiers and the scanners and that type of thing. So that person continues to work. The security is still on site, so members can drop off forms and drop off things and pick up forms if necessary. There's still some limited work going on in the building, so it's nice to have security for that reason as well on the third and fourth floors. Members are being handled over the phone regardless of whatever their issue is. That seems to be working well. We're using email for documents. What we're doing, instead of if people can't get things notarized, we're taking a driver's license and making sure that, you know, we're sure we know who we're talking to. So all of that seems to be working well. The phones are routed as we anticipated, going well. As I said, we had an increase in retirements, and that was kind of a lot of juggling to move everybody's retirement date up, but we were able to do that. One thing we have noticed is we are seeing a slight increase in calls regarding hardship. The government changed some hardship rules related to 401 plans, to defined contribution plans, and 457 plans. They don't really relate to our hardships, but I think some members might have heard that and thought that they would. So I just wanted to give you some information about the number of hardship inquiries we've had. So in the last month, since basically March 11th, we've received 9 calls related to hardships. 4 of those calls were from people that are not allowed to have a hardship. 3 were from alternative pays and a divorce, and 1 was from an active drop member. So they can't do a hardship. 2 of those have submitted paperwork. 1 of those I approved, so you need to see that one, and 1 was on the consent agenda today for denial. The other 3, one relates to medical expenses or potential medical expenses. 1 relates to just the general need for extra cash, and 1 relates to a foreclosure on a home, and we're waiting to see if they're submitting paperwork. We did talk about, do we need to change our hardship rules, but we think that with what the board approved, having, you know, medical, funeral, and also having a category that allows for other reasons that the member can submit, we think that we're covered there. So I don't anticipate at this time needing to change anything related to hardships. Of course, we'll prioritize those when they come in, but that's kind of what we're doing with hardships at this point. Is there any questions on the hardship?
When we next get together, maybe you can take us through what the changes were on the 401k, 457s versus ours, and just contrast them so we have a better understanding.
Okay. All right, I definitely will do that. The other thing that's going on, of course, investments has been very busy with his staff. They've done a great job trying to work with the portfolio during these challenging times. They have had, you know, a full plate basically every day, and they'll talk a lot about what they're seeing and what they're doing with the later agenda items today. John Holt and Damian have done a great job of keeping everybody working remotely, which is a challenge, giving everybody's different needs and computer setups. So they're doing that. The payroll files from the city, the health insurance files, and the contributions have been, you know, we're getting those timely, so we're not having a problem with that. One thing we are seeing is we do have tenants on our third and fourth floor. One of those tenants has asked for a rent deferral for 3 months, so we're working through that. We anticipate allowing the deferral for 3 months to get that paid back over a period of 9 months, but not a rent forgiveness. So that's basically what's going on. But I think, surprisingly, we're able to manage. The most complicated thing for us is just the routing of the benefit files. It takes a lot longer, I would say, but it's certainly doable. And luckily, they've put in place this scanning program, so all of the documents in a member's file are available to us electronically. So it's working, you know, surprisingly well. Are there any questions that I can answer or concerns?
Hearing none. Okay. Well,
thank you.
Thanks, Kelly. Gilbert and Kent, are you going to give us a update on the Investment Advisory Committee?
Kent, I'll go ahead and defer. Yeah, I'll defer to you, Kent.
Okay. Thanks, Gilbert. And just can I get someone to tell me that they can hear me okay?
We can.
Fine.
All right. Thank you. So before I get into the Investment Advisory Committee, just to kind of support what Kelly said, investment staff has been, we've been working fine. Appreciate all the help from John Holt and tech support. We've really, operationally, it's really not been an issue, and we've been getting good support from Makita and from executive staff as we've worked through issues, so as well as our investment managers. Shifting to the Investment Advisory Committee, and that's on page 48, which you see there. So we had a meeting scheduled for the 23rd. We did hold that meeting online, kind of like we are today. We had two members, two of the external members were unable to attend, and so it wasn't an official quorum, but we went ahead and went through the material with the members in attendance. On page 128 of your diligent packet, we have the draft minutes, and so what we do after have a meeting, we just kind of check with the people that attended to make sure we got their key points, and those are there for you. The people in attendance were Gilbert, Susan, and Scott. And so just to cover kind of a couple high points from the notes, Gilbert Garcia had requested, kind of asked about our watch list procedures and we don't have watch list criteria or procedures. We just have the ability to kind of identify to the managers that are managers of concern. And so that's how I kind of put it together when I revised the investment policy after I got here. But we'll take another look at that and have a discussion at the next Investment Advisory Committee meeting. We also reviewed the asset allocation presentations that Makita had worked through and staff's work, and there was no new asset allocation guidance, kind of consistent advice to just stay the course on rebalancing and the implementation, not making any dramatic changes. We reviewed the investment grade bond search process and the short list, and the members in attendance concurred with the process that was used as a robust process, and the manager list of five managers, which we have RFP, and I'll get back to that a little bit in the portfolio update. The other issue we talked about was the high yield guidelines. You may recall that the issue there was that we have an opportunistic type of strategy with a Loomis high yield, and that had put them into a lot of cash coming into 2000 and 19, and that caused some substantial underperformance because the world didn't turn out like they had forecast in 19. And so with the new portfolio manager that's an art, not new to the to Loomis, but took over from Dan Fuss for our portfolio, they have done a good job in 2019 of bringing our portfolio in line with the composites. They actually had outperformance, slight outperformance in the first quarter. At this point, we don't want to change the rules kind of in the middle of the battle, and so we're not tightening down the constraints now, but we plan to, in the future, to either kind of tighten down the constraints in the existing product or shift it to a more constrained product. And along those lines, Susan had advised us to kind of, with Dan Fuss gone, which is really kind of a key reason for being in this product, that we should look at, you know, our high yield alternatives. And so we're doing that on a kind of an informal basis right now, and we'll make a decision with the investment advisor committee if we think a search is appropriate there. I'll stop there. I'll first ask if Gilbert has any additional comments, and then I might just check in with investment staff, make sure I haven't missed anything. Gilbert? Gilbert, I'm not hearing anything. If you do have any comments, if you were on mute, let us know. I'll also just check in anything from investment staff. No need to comment if you don't have any comments. Just pause for a second.
Also, okay, Susan, if you have any comments as well.
Yeah, I'm. I think that Kent has covered it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Sorry about that, Susan. Okay, I think that does it on the Investment Advisory Committee update. So we'll now move over to the portfolio update. And discussion sheet starts on page 49. And, John, just take me to the next page there, I think. Yeah, and next page after that, page 51, which is a performance summary. So normally I show this kind of in the next month in the quarter. So this, you would normally see this at the May meeting, not the April meeting. And so you'll see down below in fixed income, there's some blanks there because we use mutual fund proxies. You know, we don't have all this information instantaneously, but we were trying to get a real-time picture to show both the performance of the managers and the impact on the portfolio. So looking up at the global equity managers in the top part of the table, and if you look at the excess return, which is the third numeric column over, you'll see it's a similar story to what we've seen in the past, which is underperformance from Boston Partners, kind of tip close to in-line performance from Manulife and Invesco, and then dramatic outperformance from Walter Scott. We have included an additional line here, which is because I frequently mentioned that Boston Partners has faced a pretty substantial headwind associated with their value style and a core benchmark. And so we've included that on this one. And you can see it there that really relative to the value benchmark, their underperformance is pretty de minimis, at least for the quarter. It was negative 2% for 2019, but not as bad as kind of versus the core benchmark. And emerging markets, that's the RBC, emerging markets equity, you'll see that their performance from the manager, kind of minus 22.84%, was similar to what we saw from global equity against a tougher benchmark. And so they actually outperformed their benchmark a little bit. Moving down to the fixed income, you'll see that we had negative active performance from income research. So first of all, I'll point out that kind of the global benchmark, multiverse benchmark, was down 1.1%. And the short-term bond was up, and that's a three-year treasury, was up 168. So, you know, that was good. And income research basically was flat, which is good. And, you know, given that we had expected then potentially even be a little bit negative, and they were a little bit negative in March because of the spread product, you know, they have credit exposure. And we talked about that. It's been several months ago, but we do expect them to have a little bit of a hiccup for a couple of months kind of going through this, you know, nothing like equities, and we saw that, and we also expect it to bounce back pretty quickly, and we're seeing that already. So that behaved as expected. The Vanguard bond is an index product, so we're just kind of assuming that that's working like the index. Brandywine was, that's our global bonds. They've had a position of being short the dollar and heavy in emerging markets. Neither of those worked. So even though the global bond index was near flat, they were down substantially. We also saw kind of similar dynamic with ASHMO, which is the lowest line here, or the bottom line, where now here we didn't have the index data yet, but I got that yesterday. And so they were, the index was down about 12, they were down 22, and similar issue there. The underperformance was due to some of the emerging markets exposure that they had had earlier, which kind of continued to get punished. Pacific Asset Management, second from the bottom there, they're showing negative on this, although that was using a mutual fund proxy, and we, when we got our numbers, they were positive for the quarter. We'll have more detail about that later. And again, slights, moving up a couple more lines, slight outperformance by the Loomis product for the quarter. We're real glad to see that again. They did a good job of kind of working their way out of energy in the third and fourth quarter of 2019. Not completely out, but they used some of the opportunities, the bombing in Saudi Arabia oil fields and then in September timeframe, and the Iranian assassination, that both of those kind of caused oil to go up and they exited some positions. I'll stop there on performance to see if there's any questions.
Pacific Asset, you said, was positive. You mean the variance to the market was positive, not the total return for the quarter, is that right?
That's correct, yeah. Thanks, Bill, for that clarification. That's right.
What is Walter Scott's style? Are they more growth?
They will move around a little bit, but they have been more growthy lately. And I'll ask Greg Earlbeck, who watches over Global Equity, if he has any additional comments on Walter Scott's style. What's been driving their performance? Greg?
Sure. So Walter Scott is a growth manager. What's really been driving their performance is the focus on high quality. So they're looking for companies that have strong cash flow, little or zero debt on the balance sheet. And as kind of the market started to turn down, it was investors started looking more towards quality type companies that would be able to survive the downturn. So that's exactly where Walter Scott plays. So that's worked out for him. And also, historically, Walter Scott has typically performed well when the markets are in downturns as well.
And Greg, can you kind of – so that's what we expected. What was less expected was kind of their outperformance during the rally of the last, 12 to 18 months of kind of late 18 and 19. And so how were they – well, they were a growth manager, but, I mean, they were – and I guess that's what drove their outperformance versus a core benchmark. So I'm kind of answering my own question. But, Greg, any additional commentary there?
No, you're right that, we were surprised kind of by that outperformance. But again, it's just a matter of it's very concentrated portfolio. And it's just a matter of the stock picking that they had done. They do it's a concentrated, very low turnover, long hold period portfolio.
Good.
Okay. Thanks, Greg. Any other comments on the performance? Okay, next slide, John, please, 52. So this is the impact estimate, a very busy chart, and we could end up talking about this for too long, so I don't want to spend a lot of time here, but what I try to do here is break down the contribution or impact on the overall fund by what we got from the market, the passive part of our portfolio, or I shouldn't say part of our portfolio, but what we would get if we were passive, and the structure is the way we have implemented our asset allocation, so that reflects the benchmarks of the managers versus the kind of overall composite, either the global equity benchmark or fixed income, the Barclays Multiverse. And then active is the manager's contribution kind of versus their benchmark. And so a few things to point out here. You'll see that the total impact in the first quarter was minus 148.79, so almost 150 million negative, kind of very similar, just slightly less than the positive impact from the all of 2019. And then in the structure side, you'll see some positives for global equity, which is driven by the overall benchmark it's an all cap benchmark, and our managers typically have standard benchmarks, which are not all caps, so we've been getting a little bit of benefit there. If we have a small cap rally, that'll hurt us, and we were aware of that. Most of the other issues are kind of consistent with performance we just talked about on the other page, so I won't go into a lot more detail. In fixed income, again, relatively kind of consistent with performance we just talked about. Fixed income, the negative contribution overall was almost $25 million, half of that coming from Loomis High Yield. Again, that's just being the nature of being in high yield. They actually had positive active performance versus the high yield benchmark. And in the last line, we break in income research out kind of in its own composite, so there's no structural impact there, but their active performance was versus the Treasury benchmark was negative, but slight positive impact overall. Any questions about this chart? And if everyone wants to talk about this offline, I'm glad to do it because I know it's busy. Otherwise, we'll move on. Just stop for a second. No questions. Let's go ahead and move on to the next slide, please. 53. And so, again, a review of our initiatives. We're going to talk in a lot more detail on private markets. It remains a top priority, but we expect that the ability to or that liquidations are going to dramatically slow or stop here for several months. We're also going to talk about a rebalancing here in a few minutes, so I won't go into that detail right now. Fourth bullet down, just keeping you updated. You made the decision in February to terminate the Loomis Bank loan product and concentrate that all in Pacific Asset Management for a 4% allocation. So we've been doing that a little bit at a time, and so we made a $30 million contribution at the end of February, and we got $33 million back from Loomis in the middle of March. It says we were expecting $6.6 million mid-April from Loomis. We actually heard from them yesterday they're going to hold a little bit back, so we got about half of that back. We'll get half of that back today, and then we'll make a decision about kind of how much we want to continue to contribute to Pacific Asset Management. So we did contribute another $7 million to them on March 30th, and then we'll decide if we're going to give them any more as we look at the rebalancing. We got a little bit of a benefit there just because of the timing, because Loomis was liquidating their portfolio through February, they had some cash, and we did give some to Pacific Asset Management at the end of February, but I think overall that'll be kind of an unintended structural benefit for us. Moving on to the investment grade bond search, as I talked about in the Investment Advisory Committee, they were concurred with the process and the short list that we used. We sent RFPs to six shortlist firms, five. It turned out didn't have the right product, so we ended up only going to get proposals from five. We've gotten a couple back already. Staff will look at those pretty hard next week, do some evaluation, and we'll make some recommendations to the Investment Advisory Committee, who would like to interview the top 2 to 3 managers. We still think we're on track for a June board recommendation. Talked about the high yield guidelines. Staff is investment manager focused right now. We're taking a deeper dive on the Boston Partners. Again, it is their underperformance is primarily driven by value, but we just want to make sure that maintain high conviction in them. Mike Ian has been doing a lot of work on Brandywine, and we also on the private equity side continue to work on our engagement or kind of how to appropriately manage the Huff situation, our other kind of non-Lone Star private equity fund. I think that's it on investment initiatives. John, what's the next slide? Let's see. Yeah, so our investment reviewer calendar, we will talk with AEW later today. Anything else? Let me just check my notes here. I think I covered everything there. Anything else on a portfolio or anything on questions on the portfolio update before we move on to talk about rebalancing and liquidity? Okay. Slide 55, John, please. And we're required by investment policy to inform you of any rebalancing activity. So we did rebalance and put $36 million into global equities on, I think that was Monday the 16th. Late in the day on Monday the 16th, and so we have a report on that transaction. We're also starting to a policy of keeping our, or I guess a program of keeping cash topped off at $50 million and drawing down equities. And so that is an effective rebalancing evolution. So we wanted to make sure that you were aware of that. On the next slide, we just have the report for the global equity rebalancing. I won't go into all the detail here, but it was $36 million that we took from cash and gave that to global equity. Simultaneously with that, income research was slightly overweight on a percentage basis, and so we initiated a redemption from them at that time on the 13th to help supplement that global equity contribution. That was kind of in the thick of things, and income research, you know, told us that, you know, the market was very thin, and so they had asked for 7 days, and I think we ended up giving them 10 for that liquidation, and we got our money on time with kind of, you know, not a lot of problem there, so that worked just like it was supposed to. So that's the rebalancing we did. I want to thank Makita, who was available over that weekend to kind of evaluate our, there were several scenarios that we were looking at and gave us some guidance and, you know, the quick approval on our ultimate recommendation there. So everything really worked well there. I'll just stop for a second for any questions on that rebalancing action. And then, John, we'll move it forward to the presentation, please.
Rebalancing into equities, you did it at the right time. It's bounced back pretty good.
Yeah. I think we're, I'm happy with how all that works. You can never time it perfectly, but, it did well. Thanks, Bill. And
I think
turning to the next.
Ken, I'd also say I think it's worth noting that, you know, kind of the Makita and staff decision to do the safety reserve, you know, a year and a half ago, the wisdom of that is incredibly evident in what we just experienced, so.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. And I thank you guys, since that was executed before I got here, so I take absolutely no credit, but I am reaping the benefits, so thank you.
Well, I think you have to remember that none of these rebalancing things you probably would have done if you didn't have that safety reserve.
I concur.
Absolutely.
That's definitely true. And just also being disciplined with what bucket gets filled at what measure, and just staying true to that process, it'll you know, you can't time this. You just can't.
Well, we always talk here about being emotionally healthy, and not just individually, but actually as a functioning investment team. And it's clear that you all maintained your emotional health to make good, wise decisions. And it wasn't the decisions you made 2 or 3 weeks ago that were wise, yet they were. It was the decisions that were made beforehand that created the environment where you could do this. And I think it's always important to kind of note and acknowledge that, because, you know, I think the craziness is going to continue in forms, you know, we really can't completely figure out right now, but you know, it's just really good to see what you guys did in the last couple weeks.
Well said. I agree. Very well said.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Nick. Okay, so now I want to talk a little bit about what we saw kind of in the last few weeks, and how that impacts what we may be able to do in the future and how we're thinking about things. So if we turn to page 60, just a couple things to point out here. You know, we did see global equity drop from kind of a peak of about $525 million in mid-February to the data point we had when we were looking at things for our rebalancing was $403 million on March 13th. It actually dropped down below that, as you know. It continued to go down for a few days. We had our $36 million rebalancing, and then it was back to $439. So coincidentally, that's as of March 31st, we were essentially back even. If you take $439 less the $36 million contribution, we're back to that $403, but I checked it this morning, and we're at $457 just in global equity, which is kind of $421 net of that contribution. So we made some money there. So the safety reserve totaled $269 million as of March 31. Represents, so we have about 10 million a month of net outflows on average, not 10 million every month, but on average. And so that's 27 months of coverage that we have in the safety reserve for our expected net cash outflow. And so a couple things we're thinking about, you know, is that safety reserve, it's really, and for those of you, I think we talked about this in kind of our initiative orientation reviews with the new board members as they've come through, but the safety reserve is really kind of targeted at 2.5 years payments, which is $300 million. And so the 15% allocation was just what that was, $300 million was at the when the fund was valued at $2 billion. And so it's now, or it was kind of the closer at the trough, kind of near 20%. So one of the things we need to do there, and I'll get to this in a second, is we need to probably revise the investment policy just a little bit to make to add that language about what the safety reserve is designed for, and kind of allow us to have that $300 million perspective when we are evaluating rebalancing. The next slide on page 61, please, John. So I already talked a little bit, you know, that the bond market liquidity was constrained, and that did hurt. Or not hurt, but we were aware of that, and that's expected in these times of distress. Okay. I think I've covered the main points on that one. So I want to go through a couple of asset allocation slides. Page 62, please, John. So this is at the end of March, which is our book value views. So the private assets are marked kind of at their you know, their last report. A lot of times that's September 30th, you know, just for any cash flows. A couple of them we have December 31st numbers. So you'll see here, you know, global equities at 23.3%, so slightly below the 22% minimum there. Fixed income overall is at 29%. That the target there is 35%. And the safety reserve, you know, we have a total of $269 million in the safety reserve, but you know, again, they kind of have some denominator issues, which makes it look on a percentage basis closer than the dollar amount we really want. Also, I'll note here that if you look down kind of the next four kind of credit-based bond allocations, global bonds, bank loans, high-yield bonds, they're all kind of, you know, 3-plus percent and a little bit higher. Now, on the next slide, page 63, please, John, what we've done here is Ryan did most of this work, is we went through the portfolio, and Ryan's going to talk more about this in the private market presentation, but we marked down private market assets kind of based on the information that we saw. So, you know, energy, we marked down more, you know, real estate or our working assets, we marked down less, but what that shows is that, you know, first of all, our portfolio went from like 1.8 billion to 1.6, and the allocations have changed. So our bond allocations are kind of overall we're at 34% versus 35 goals, so we're pretty close. And the kind of credit-based bond allocations are near or over target. And this, we want to bring this into our evaluation for rebalancing, because if we think that private equity is a lot less than it's being shown, we could be over-allocated to bonds. And so we want to be sensitive to this, and probably what that leads us to do is to seek more advice from the investment advisory committee and the board, kind of working through our the situation, especially on the, if we have, we don't expect any significant private market distributions, but if we did, we'd want to be thoughtful about that. Next page just shows a comparison of kind of the allocation based on the book value versus the adjusted NAV. And just take a quick look to compare any of those. Okay. I'll stop here and just see if there's any questions before we talk about initiative and considerations.
Yeah, I think as you look at this, and I think what you're doing makes sense, you probably need to look at, you know, the implementation plan that we had as an appendix as to, you know, where do we go going forward, given what the status of these different asset classes are. We may just want to take a hard look at that, too, to make sure any new dollars we think makes the most sense.
Hi, yep. It's Tina.
I have one comment. Maybe we relook when we think about editing the language for some of the allocations, that the safety reserve is maybe a component of time where we're having, like, you know, so we're 2.5 years out and whatever that percentage is, or greater than, less than, what have you, as opposed to just a percent allocation, but just more a function of time that we give ourselves for payment.
Thanks, Tina. So just to repeat what I heard, when we're looking at the safety reserve kind of language adjustments, think of that as kind of a time issue there, how many months of payments. And then, Bill, you had suggested that we look at the implementation plan as kind of under the new situation that we find ourselves in. And so we will look at that. We're going to look at everything you know, closer. I think at least right now it sets us in good stead and keeps us from doing anything kind of too bold without checking in with the board. And so, but we'll see if we need to do anything special there. I actually had looked at and had proposed some language that we might want to adjust, but I felt like it was too complicated and complex. And so I haven't been able to find a better mousetrap yet, but we'll keep working on that. John Holt, next slide, please. Okay. So, a few of the things that we're working on in terms of initiatives, and got a little bit of repeat here. So we did the $36 million rebalance. We're going to be keeping cash topped off at $50 million. And the thing there is that even though we expect bond liquidity to get better, if we go into another distress scenario, you know, we don't want to need to access income research right away. So by keeping in cash topped off 50%, we can kind of let income research take their time. They know, you know, they have 4 weeks to get this money for us. They can be very optimistic in raising the cash. Should be very low cost, and we'll adjust that number kind of with our cash flow projections to try to maintain $50 million. Also, if for some reason kind of there was ever any disruption in our contributions, that gives us almost two months of contributions on its own. So that's why we're doing that. We've talked about also incorporating a private market valuation discounts into our allocation and rebalancing views and the IPS language. Next slide, John. Okay. And check my notes here. So the thing I wanted to point here is that we don't have dry powder now. So if the market, even as we were looking at things kind of in the, you know, after March 16th, what I saw was that if the market continued to go down, I didn't really have a liquidity source that I could use to put money into equities. And so, because I would have been drawing, we would have had to draw down fixed income below target allocations. I mean, they were above minimums, but they were below targets. And so we did have that one bullet in the gun and we used it, but there's really not a lot more there. And the board or the investment advisory committee, you know, can give us guidance if, in Makita, I mean, I think Makita's guidance we've already received is kind of, you know, don't want to weaken the protection that's provided by the fixed income. But I just wanted to make clear kind of that we wouldn't be able to do that again if markets dropped. And now, as we replenish the portfolio, we might be able to, or if we looked at the, replenish with private market liquidations, or maybe if we took a view if things improved in kind of a particular way, and we looked at a view with discounted private markets, it might work, but probably not. I'll stop here to see if there's any comments. Ask Makita and Leo if you had any perspective on this or overall on kind of asset allocation and rebalancing for DPSP.
Thank you, Ken, and good morning, everyone. Can you hear me well?
Yep, fine. We can
hear you.
Great. There is no silver bullet here. There's always multiple approaches that can be pursued. We have to always keep in mind the liquidity position of the fund. There's still a lot of unknowns as to the values and the timing for distributions and the illiquid side. None of this should come as a surprise to you. This is a big driver. This unknown is a big reason, together with the liquidity profile of the fund, why the safety reserve exists. At some point in time, the safety reserve may be less critical. So rebalancing into it and staying the course with the asset allocation, it seems to be something that we'll continue to debate and discuss over the future. At some point in time, if we continue to draw on the safety reserve, we'll have to, you know, find, you know, capital from other places to top it off. On the other hand, you know, in situations like this, when the safety reserve has plenty of liquidity, it can be a source of capital to fund other areas that may be underwater. So, it involves some qualitative judgment, and to the extent we can document things better in the policy statement, as Kent alluded, I think that would work. But ultimately, you know, we will have to make some judgments, and we'll use our best collective knowledge, you know, discussing with the Investment Advisory Committee staff and MIKIA resources to come up with the best go-forward course. Aaron, anything you want to add?
No, I think you summed it up well. It's a fine line of following a process, but also being thoughtful and adjusting if needed, but not throwing the plan out the window. And I think Ken and the team are doing a great job of that.
How do you guys? How often do you guys look to see what your expected returns are in some of these asset classes, like global bonds, where there's a lot of negative interest rates and things like that? Do you look at that annually to reevaluate whether or not that's a class you should be in?
The default case is yes, we do that annually, but there's two things that I think we're mixing here. Number one is how often and with what frequency do we project estimated, you know, returns, volatility correlations for a variety of asset class. So the default is to do it yearly. We have been debating whether to do it an additional time this year, typically around mid-year. There's been a lot of volatility. To some degree, some asset classes move way down and some recoup more than half of their losses. So we're still debating whether that would be appropriate or not. To give you perspective, in 2008, we did it more than once. Secondly, I think your question was, well, if the asset class makes sense or not for a given client, I would say that is more of an ongoing issue. Every quarter, at least, we'll review what you own and where you are, and that can trigger discussions. For example, that has led to decisions, or at the minimum, discussions on a variety of asset classes and managers that implement those asset classes exposures on your behalf. So I think that is more ongoing. With respect to global bonds, you may recall that at the last meeting when we looked at asset allocation, we didn't really categorize global bonds as being the defensive side, the risk mitigation side. You know, it takes a lot of currency exposure. I would imagine, given the work we've done, and we know the Brandywine strategy quite well and think overall highly of it, but it's not really defensive in nature. At least half of that return stream we would expect would come from currencies. And currencies can be volatile. And during times of distress, according to higher position, it can be very defensive or it can be, you know, or it can suffer big losses. So from that perspective, we don't typically consider that. Even though it's typically, you know, higher quality bonds, the currency can be more than offsetting any gains that you get on income. And now interest rates are very low globally, so currencies will dominate likely much more than half of the return stream of that fund. It's a cheap way to get currency exposure. If you get a currency manager, it likely will cost you a lot more than you're paying branding money. So from that perspective, it's a good trade, and it does provide some diversification, but it shouldn't be thought of as a defensive holding in your portfolio.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Leo. And I just want to also, ask Ryan if he has any questions on the rebalancing and liquidity, and then I'll just make a couple intro comments, and we'll shift over to private markets. So, Ryan, anything on rebalancing liquidity?
No, I think we're going to do it on private markets, that we just don't expect a whole lot coming back.
Okay, thanks. So, I'll just stop for just one second. Any final questions or comments on rebalancing liquidity while we're waiting? I'll just intro Ryan. He's done his quarterly work on private market cash flow. It's a little bit more difficult this time around. He's going to spend a little time talking about the discounted view, how we're thinking about that, and what we expect from private markets going forward. So, Bill, if it's okay with you, we'll just shift it over to Ryan.
Yep. Go ahead.
All right. Thanks, Kent. John, if you can go to 69, start. So, Kent said, this quarter was it'll look a lot different and a little bit more difficult than the standard kind of quarterly estimates and refreshing our numbers. But we wanted to just kind of start with, I know we covered this in January, but a review of how we're coming up with these distribution estimates or projections. On some of the real estate and natural resources where we directly own it, we have a little bit more control and visibility into timing of sales and when they might occur. For the private equity and infrastructure funds, we're kind of just taking more of a, we expect this fund to distribute proceeds over, 2 to 4 years and a third, or 50-50 coming back. So these estimates are always very imprecise, and right now more so than ever. We've seen it on, the four sales that are kind of in process that everyone is just tapping the brakes and putting an indefinite hold on a process, even if they had money hard. A few cases, so we really don't expect any sales coming back really for 6 to 9 months, 6 months minimum, I would say. So numbers are always squishy, a little bit more squishy right now. I'll get into kind of how we adjusted for that. So the next few slides are the bridge charts. I'm going to skip ahead of those because we'll kind of come back to that when we get to the valuation adjustment. On 72, this is kind of the quarterly cash flow coming out of private assets. In Q1, we actually got an additional $1.5 million from Hancock, but still, including that, it's the lowest quarter we've had since we started doing this in Q4 16. So, and it's only quarter below $20 million. So, on the next chart, one of the few charts we look at lately where flattening the curve is not a good thing. So we're going a little bit of the wrong direction there, but we're starting to see kind of those distributions dry up coming out of the private asset portfolio. So on 74, this is the chart where the solid blue line is what we've received by quarter cumulative building up on the net inflows. And the two dotted lines are what we've seen kind of in a prior year and prior quarter projections and how they've moved. So this is where you can really see that we basically went through on an asset-by-asset basis and pretty much pushed back everything that we thought was going to occur in 2020 outside of a few minor exceptions into 2021. So we've basically just taken the whole schedule and pushed it back a year or three quarters at this point. And as I mentioned, on some of the specific sales that we've been talking about on the real estate side, they've come to a complete halt. There's a legend in the closed session folder of kind of the asset-by-asset buildup again and what the projections are per year. And then what we added last quarter was kind of, if you want to know more specifically about a certain investment and what schedule we're using and why, we have the assumptions legend in there as well. So on 75, and this is where we really get into the specific valuation adjustments we took to get to kind of this estimated current NAV view on private markets, and that obviously has implications in lots of different areas, but including rebalancing and allocation. So Ken mentioned earlier, most of the values we have to get to this $855 million in private markets is either a 930 or 1231 number, which now is kind of stale, and given the severity of the decline, not realistic. So similar to what we do on the distribution forecast, we went asset by asset and just looked at, what should we discount this asset, to get a better estimate of what the current NAV would be. And you guys know we have considerable energy exposure in the private equity portfolio and considerable retail exposure in the real estate portfolio, which Ron AEW will get into. mixed, but there's a schedule in closed session, again, that kind of show that by the discount. The discounts range from 10 to 60% across the board. You know, 10% is more of a stable ag portfolio, where 60 is our energy private equity. We were kind of looking, we did this mid-March, and, you know, equity markets were down 30% at the time. I checked yesterday that the Russell 2000, the small cap index, is still down 28% year to date. So that's lagging the larger cap, which is probably a better proxy for the private equity anyways. So using that adjustment, you kind of see by asset class what it was. It's about a 30% discount overall to the private market's value, which would bring it down to $595 million. So I'm going to pause there to see if there's any questions on kind of the valuation adjustment part of the exercise this quarter. Okay.
Hey, Ryan, it's Nick. Are you all going to talk later about sort of the implications of this on all the other kind of major metrics of the pension fund, if we were to sort of impute this sort of adjustment on our portfolio?
I think by later, maybe next month, I think it was kind of too soon to kind of think through all those implications. I know Kelly looked at some metrics, you know, and I don't know if she wants to get into that now or not on kind of what this means on the actuarial side, but, you know. I think as we incorporate this view, there's more to look at for sure.
I mean, I took the kind of mid-March asset value reduction here as adjusted and ran it through the Siegel funding model just to kind of see the impact. So I have an idea if nothing came back ever and those, you know, prices remained where they are, which, you know, we're not making that call. Our funding level will drop, of course, and what it looked like when I ran those through, given, you know, these adjustments and no recovery, was about 36% funded. Down from 45, but I don't want to scare anybody, you know, with that, because that was just one point in time. What if, you know, with no adjustments? And Siegel will be in the May meeting, and we can talk more about that and the other assumptions.
Yeah, this is Kent. Just to add a little more color to that, you know, I think this is helpful for us as we look at the allocation and the rebalancing and the potential expectation for redemptions, and it's a rough process, you know, with a lot of uncertainty in it, but it's appropriate right now. As we move forward, especially once we start getting March 30 marks from the managers, you know, that will give us better information, kind of that is not so rough, and we'll kind of evaluate where to go from there. That's all I have. Back to you, Ryan.
Okay. And one thing we're going to try to communicate to managers, especially on the real estate side, is even if an appraisal isn't due March 31, you guys need to do an internal valuation update based on the market so we can start getting more realistic numbers in here and not have to wait till end of 20 to get those in. So, and as Kelly said, the model tunes kind of current, the estimated NAV, you know, is just, we receive that over, you know, a 1 to 4 year period. We're not making any assumptions on NAV recovery. You know, I would say, I expect some of these to bounce back, and it's downturn, you know, some of these more sensitive assets, there's a potential for permanent loss of capital, but, you know, some asset classes should rebound with the market. When that occurs.
Right. It was just really just kind of worst case, quick and dirty, you know, what happens if this asset level declines and doesn't recover at all other than kind of the natural assumed rate return, which we don't really think is likely.
But I think it is fair to say that, you know, your percent that you had, the 36% funded versus, I think we were right at, was it 48 or 49 at year-end 20,
we
last
45.
year? 45, yeah. Yeah. So it's probably reality is something probably in between those two. So, you know, I think that creating a way to sort of digest these anticipated changes in market values and what that means to the bigger picture and having that as a process that then you can change inputs on is a real positive thing. It sounds like you've done that and just want to continue to encourage that sort of thinking.
And we'll keep looking at it as we go.
Yeah.
Ryan, you wanted to take us through the last couple slides?
Yeah, John 76. This is kind of the bridge chart from earlier that just kind of includes the estimated NAV adjustment for the recent downturn in here. So just visually showing the 855 down to the 595. On 77, this is kind of the forward projection chart where we added the orange dash line, which shows, you know, at the lower NAV, you would expect a lower total amount coming back from private markets overall. The same trend, but just kind of from a lower starting base. And then last one I'm going to cover is on 78, just looking at year-by-year changes to estimated net distributions. The black bar is kind of what we had prior quarter, this huge amount coming out in 2021. The blue is the current projection at the book value, and the orange is the current projection at the estimated adjusted NAV. So you can see where I talked about a lot of it getting pushed from 2021 into 2020 and 2021 pushed back a year shows up there. So, and it's Kent, you know, we've talked about in the rebalancing is, you know, where before we had talked about we're going to, you know, we get all this money back and be able to redeploy it to equity, you know, doesn't look like any of that's going to occur for, you know, next 6 to 9 months.
All right, thanks, Brian. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I'm not going to cover the last one. So any other questions, or we can move on to AEW?
Before we do that, we're going to be going into AEW and then going into closed session pretty much. We only have one other open item other than if there's any motions, which we don't anticipate. But Kelly, can you handle your executive director's report now? And then we'll go to AEW.
Okay, sure. So on the executive director's report, you have the NCFER monitor, as always. Just an update on open records requests. We've only received one since the last meeting. We received that after Governor Abbott changed the rules related to, or suspended the rules related to open records requests. Josh will talk more about that in legal session. But basically, we want to make sure we treat everybody equally on open records requests. And so we basically won't be processing any until the office opens back up. There are some we possibly could get the information remotely, but we don't want to appear that we're picking and choosing what we're going to answer. So we're going to wait until the office opens up to answer open records requests that come in between now and that time.
Okay, good enough. Okay, Ryan, back to you on the – you're going to do one slide on open session, then we're going to go into closed session.
Yeah, AEW should already be on the line over there, but wanted to kind of give a high-level review of what we're talking about here before they jump into the weeds. But so just kind of – AEW is the investment manager on the portfolio, and they took it over in 2015. When I talk about RED or RCH, that is the real estate retail operating company that they manage. The portfolio is $290 million, so it's about 15% of the overall plan, $290 million before adjustment.
Ryan, do you want to go to the next slide? You want to go to the next slide? There we go. I think.
All right. I'm looking at my paper, not the screen. So here we go. RCH, which is Red Consolidated Holdings, key thing here is it's a living, breathing development, management, leasing, asset management company with 100 employees out in Phoenix, focus on retail property. So Ron will get into the fund they've been having collecting rent or trying to first couple weeks of this month. Concentration is in Southwest and Midwest U.S., and it's a very complex investment with many different types of securities that each of the partners owns and different partners throughout. So we'll cover all the details of that. So that's piece one that we still own. the second part of it is Camel Square, which is 100% owned by DPFP, 15 and a half acres in a prime location at 44th and Camelback out in Phoenix that is in the process of being redeveloped. Rezoning was approved kind of late last year. So that, I think, will probably transition now over to the separate Zoom and dial in for the closed session.
Right.
Okay.
So Melissa sent out an email to the board members at 9:24 a.m. this morning. So if you check your email, what we're going to do is we want to leave the open session of the Zoom as well as the audio open for the public so they can hang out and wait if they want until the end of the meeting. As Bill said, we believe we've done, you know, most of the open items. We still have a supplemental meeting to do, which is just approval of the minutes. But what the board members need to do is go to the email that Melissa sent at 9:24, click on that Zoom link, so you'll leave this Zoom, and then redial in. It's the same phone number but a different access code, and that will get you into the closed session.
Okay, so
you want us to do that right now? You want us to do that right now, Kelly?
Yes.
If I'm just on audio and not Zoom, do I have to do anything?
Well, if you are, if you're not on Zoom, you won't be able to see the AEW presentation. But yes, and actually, if you're just on audio, you still need to call back in to hear.
Okay, good. Can you tell John? I'm going to switch phones because one, this one, this other phone, he has. It's my. So I'll come in on 214-906-9135.
Okay, thank
if
you.
John has that.
He'll have it.
Kelly,
okay,
just confirming,
yeah.
Nikita should call in as well for this closed session.
Yes, if you want to hear the AEW presentation, you're welcome to join us.
Perfect. Just wanted to confirm that. Yeah, we will be calling. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, we will need to sign off when we do the legal part, but other than that.
Okay, thank you. I'll call him in. Bye.
And to the open public, I mean, there will be nothing other than the supplemental meeting.
Yeah, okay.
Right. We're not anticipating any motions coming out of the closed session. You know, obviously that could change, but we're not anticipating any motions.
Okay. We will fall back in and.
Kelly, real quick, I just wanted to say if Susan doesn't have the Zoom link pulled up to go through the AEW presentation, she can always just be logged into Diligent and view it through there and follow along.
Okay. All right, we'll let her know when we get into closed session. Thank you.
Okay, John, let me know when we've got everybody.
Will do.
Okay, I'm on.
Gilbert Garcia is on.
Queen is on.
Alan Vaught's on.
Steve on? Or Nick?
Steve is on.
What about Mark?
I'm on.
Steve is here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, whoever that was, I could hear you. That's Steve?
Yes, sir.
Nick's okay. On.
Do we have everybody, John?
Yeah, looks that way, yeah.
Okay.
Do we have Joe and Armando, John?
Yes, I'm on. Joe's on.
Yes, ma'am, I'm here.
Okay, then we can try to wrap this up then. We just need a motion to adjourn the regular meeting.
So move.
That was Susan?
Yes.
Okay. Second from somebody?
Armando.
Armando, thank you. All in favor? Aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? No. Okay, and then we just reconvene the supplemental, and what we have is the approval, the minutes from the last meeting, the consent, really our only item, everything else. So get somebody to motion that.
Motion. So move, Gilbert.
Gilbert moved it. Anybody else
second
it?
Second Alan.
Alan seconded it. Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
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 Okay, not being nothing else, we can just move to adjourn this meeting. If we get a motion.
So I'll
move. Move.
Okay, we got a... I think that was Susan moved it. Tina, did you second?
Yes.
I think a lot of people second.
Okay. You'll get the official sanction.
Okay.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 No.